Conway, Judge Clary, Judge Cochran. The Honorable Francis J. Conley presiding.
Thank you. Let's all be seated. Good morning. Our first case this morning is a LTI 9500 LLC versus Security Warehouse. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, respondent will have 15 minutes, and then finally the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Whenever you're ready, just approach the microphone. You can adjust the podium to your level and just begin by telling us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Good morning. May it please court, counsel, I'm Justin Weinberg, representing the appellant LTI 9500. We're here today about an agreement that has stood for over 50 years. The agreement ended a dispute between the two initial parties that entered into it regarding building access. This agreement ended a dispute regarding parking. This agreement also provides for the only access that my client's building has to certain parking spots and provides for the only access off of Washington Avenue. Security argues that this agreement expires year to year, that effectively the parties entered into a one-year agreement back in 1967. But given what I just said about how it ended a dispute and provides the only access to critical parking spots and the only access off of Washington Avenue, it's nonsensical that these parties would have entered into a one-year contract. Instead, they entered into a contract that would renew and extend every single year upon the payment of monies by LTI, and provided that LTI simply abided by the balance of the agreement. Chiefly, and namely, making sure that there aren't any parking violations, which again is what this agreement went to resolve between the two initial parties.
Counsel, what are we to make of the language in paragraph 8, together with the acceptance thereof?
So that's the crux of this, and that's where the District Court and Security Warehouse focuses their entire argument, is together whereof. A couple of different ways to respond to that. Number one, under the last antecedent rule, we agree that together with acceptance thereof does in fact have meaning, but it only has meaning and it's not unfettered right and discretion of Security to simply say, no, thank you, we're not taking your check. They have that right if LTI, there's two things that happen. Number one, the agreement otherwise terminated sometime after May 1st. Automatically is what paragraph 8 of the original 1967 agreement states. Or number two, if there was parking violations and the deposit in the, for these parking violations failed, there's a 60-day notice by Security Warehouse to say this isn't working, you need to do something about it. So if one of those two things happen, at that point, that's when Security can reject the payment. But
well, you're talking about the two unless clauses.
The two unless clauses, exactly.
But I understand that argument, but still, we're still left with the language, the acceptance thereof. Why have that language in there at all?
For exactly those two reasons. Because if you think about it, if it ended up terminating automatically sometime after May 1st, then what LTI could do, if you didn't have that language, is simply tender a check and revive the agreement. Every single time, or if there was a 60-day notice on the parking.
But if you remove the language together with acceptance thereof, wouldn't you have the same meaning? Because it would automatically be extended by payment of the monies due unless it's otherwise automatically been terminated or the other condition is met.
Well, you
I'm not sure I follow your argument there.
Because I think that together with acceptance thereof goes exactly to automatic. This is an automatic extension of the exact same agreement year after year after year. If you didn't have that language together with the acceptance thereof, you wouldn't need the automatic either. You just simply say that LTI would make a payment, and then it would just continue on year after year. Or he could just simply say that LTI owes a payment year after year. There'd be no reason to have the words automatically extends by the payment. It's a self-executing agreement by when you insert the words automatic.
But doesn't your interpretation render that language together with acceptance thereof meaningless?
No. And in fact, what it really does is we are giving it meaning. We just simply, what it doesn't mean, it does not mean that they have the unfettered right and absolute discretion to reject our payment for whatever reason. We're saying they do have the right, provided those one of those two unless provisos applies. And so we're not taking out the meaning. Security Warehouse, on the other hand, wants to render automatic utterly meaningless and simply state that, well, you know, your payment year after year and this automatic extension of the agreement, that means nothing because we have the right to reject it on a whim and absolutely without any reason whatsoever. So when we end up tendering the payment, their acceptance issues as a matter of course automatically unless one of those two things has occurred. And the record establishes neither one of those two things has occurred up to the date that they ended up rejecting our payment. And again, it does make sense because it prevents LTI from reviving an otherwise terminated agreement. In addition, even without those canons, acceptance, we can still give it meaning because acceptance means receipt. We provide numerous definitions, both legal and lay definitions, that state acceptance means receipt and that there's nothing else that needs to be done beyond receipt. Security Warehouse cites a definition as well. But what they failed to admit was the very first definition of acceptance, and it stated receipt. And it says the act of receiving something offered. So all we have to do, if we think about it again, and it makes sense given the term automatic, LTI ends up sending the payment in. And Security Warehouse needs to receive it. It is unquestioned that they received this payment because they had it and they rejected it. They admitted that they received it. So we give acceptance meaning even without the last antecedent rule by its very definition, both legally and the lay definition of that. The automatic, again, is a self-executing component of it that provided we end up making the payment. It also goes to the argument that the this is an extension. It doesn't expire every single year. The agreement lives on as it has for over 50 years by making our payment. The most critical, however, and what security ignores and what the district court ignored was the Third Amendment. And security tells us in page 18 of their brief that we have to read the Third Amendment. We all agree on that, that this amendment does in fact have meaning. And
where, a lot of the amendments don't have numbers on them. So in your, Mr. Weinberg, in your addendum, what page should we be looking at for the Third Amendment?
We are looking at our addendum, page 25.
Thank you very much.
And it's under paragraph 2.
The one that says it's not an easement.
Nope. Paragraph number 2. I'll address that.
That's paragraph 6. Yeah. I apologize. It wasn't paragraph 2, Mr. Wynn.
Correct. And I agree. The amendment itself is not an easement, but the agreement is.
We'll see.
What this states, and this is critical, this happened in 2015, 48 years after this was signed. And I think it gives us is why our interpretation is the best interpretation. It says it's amended to clarify the mechanism for the payment of the fee. The mechanism. How is it supposed to work? How do you make the payment? It then goes on to state lot one owner, LTI, shall pay lot two owner annually on April 15 of every year. The following amounts. And it includes the annual fee. Nowhere in there do we see together with acceptance thereof? Nowhere in there do we see that Security Warehouse has to take the affirmative step of telling us that they accepted that payment. It supports our argument about the provisos. It supports our argument that acceptance means receipt. And they were deliberate in choosing the words clarify the mechanism by which the payment is going to be made. It also makes sense because...
Well, wouldn't... you know, when I looked at that, I guess, Third Amendment as a whole, what I saw mainly was, you know, first of all, sort of, you know, upping up the annual fee, and then more importantly, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that's the first time I saw a discussion that, you know, you should pay a portion of the property taxes. Would that be a fair statement?
In the original agreement, there's a reference to paying some property taxes.
But this is a mechanism.
It's much more calculated about the amounts.
But probably because they've gone up since 1967.
Correct. And I think if we take that piece, and I understand the question about calculation, but we have three words. We have the mechanism for calculation, and that talks about how we're going to calculate those, and then we have the mechanism for payment, and that's the critical component.
Council, that same paragraph references license fees, and then we go on to paragraph 6 that makes clear it's not an easement. The significance of the fact that it's a license and not an easement?
So addressing that component about whether or not it's an easement or a license, we do believe it is an easement. And the courts in Minnesota have been clear as to what an easement versus a license is. Critically here, the district court made a finding that this has characteristics of both an easement and a license. The district court made the finding that it was a license after it engaged in making credibility decisions and weighing the evidence, which is entirely inappropriate.
What were the credibility determinations that you're alleging were made?
The 11 times that the first attorney in the termination notice referred to it as an easement, and when LTI's subsequent counsel, who's the chair of the real estate section at that firm, referred to it as an easement and said, well, that was just loose talk. That's not really an easement. That's a credibility determination, and that's weighing the evidence that goes towards it. But this has all the characteristics.
Well, I mean, you know, following up on Judge Cochran's excellent question, I mean, is that really, I didn't see anyone in the order that said, oh, and by the way, I believed the lawyer. I mean, I thought that was more like, well, one side is calling it an easement and, you know, you're using that against them, which is fine. But I don't know if that's a credibility determination except a reference to the fact that their own side referred to it as an easement when these things started to go back and forth in sort of correspondence.
But that's exactly why there's a material, there's an issue of fact on that, and it goes to Judge Cleary's question. Well, you call this a license fee, so how then can it be an easement? Everybody's called it an easement. They called it an easement in the Second Amendment, and they referred to it.
Well, you know, I mean, I could call that lamp a lighthouse, and that doesn't mean it's a lighthouse.
Absolutely.
I mean, we look at what it is.
Correct.
And am I correct in saying, Mr. Weinberg, when I looked at the original agreement, I didn't see something along the lines, and maybe I'm wrong, you know, in a typical easement, it sort of binds all successor parties, you know, who, you know, like an easement. So it's not just if I own the property, if I sell it to Judge Cochran, you know, it still binds it. I didn't see any of that language. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong about
okay.
But
is that is any of that language in any of the subsequent amendments?
It is not in subsequent amendments, but for the characteristics of an easement, whether you bind the party and it runs exclusively to the party or you bind and it runs with the land, that's a negotiated term. Mm-hmm. It's not one of the characteristics of an easement. What we do have for...
Just like acceptance?
different than acceptance, but point taken.
You know, isn't a... Your, well, isn't a stronger argument is, you know, at the end of the day, you know, you point to some language in the original amendment, they point to some other language. You know, we're supposed to sort of look at the whole the whole agreement as a whole.
Correct.
And, you know, it's speaking for myself only, not the panel, it, you know, I would have expected if Well, I would have expected a better notice of default provision, you know, from 1967, but, you know, it's 1967. And, you know, up to this time, it does seem odd that if they had an automatic right to terminate this agreement, you know, every May 1, you know, it's odd that that's their argument, but at the same time, if there's these default provisions in the other sections, there's a 60-day notice to cure, but they could terminate it anyway. And the correspondence going back, up until someone thought of this argument, seemed to be focusing on a default provision, i.e., you know, you were blocking the parking, there was snow, I can't remember something about a truck, maybe I'm wrong. And then all of a sudden somebody found, oh.
Oh, by the way, here's
this could work.
Back. It, right, exactly. And it guts the Third Amendment as well, which, again, we have to read this as a whole, because they changed it. If we didn't make that payment, why would you need a lien against the property? You wouldn't need a lien against the property. It would just automatically terminate under Security Warehouse's interpretation. That's why they only want to focus on paragraph 8 and those four words. Because
in 2015 they amended the agreement. It seems to me they made clear, both parties agreed to this, that it's a license fee and not an easement. I mean, they even specified that it's not a recordable interest and not an easement. And you cite the clarify mechanism language to make the argument that no longer should there be any question regarding the acceptance thereof by security. But at least the way I read this, it could have, but did not, clarify that earlier language. I mean, that language is still hanging out there back in paragraph 8. I mean, I understand that it wasn't cited for a long time, but it's still there.
And I didn't draft it, but I will tell you that I do agree, and I agree with something that Judge Connolly stated earlier. It's sloppy drafting. But you can't say that we're going to clarify the mechanism of how these payments are going to be made and then state that we're going to have to pay security, and then also state, by the way, if you're late, there's going to be a lien against the property, and there's going to bear interest on that late payment, when in fact the 1967 agreement, if we just read that only, if we're late, it's gone.
Well,
it doesn't renew.
Here's my problem. We all agree it's sloppy drafting, but all these years later in 2015, I presume they went back and read this. Why not everyone looking at this acceptance thereof, we better clarify that. Why not come right out and clarify that?
That's a great question, and one that should be decided by a finder of fact. It's not appropriate for summary judgment.
Okay.
But that's an excellent question, and one I think that we would get to ultimately when we're able to establish the record. Just a couple more points on this indicia of an easement versus a license. Again, license fee easement is used all over the course of 50 years between these parties. But when we look at the characteristics of an easement, it gives a right and access to land. That's a characteristic of an easement, not a license. It describes the access area by a legal description. That's a characteristic of an easement, not a license. It ends up being recorded, and every conveyance of land needs to be recorded. We have to pay real estate taxes, which is tied directly to the land. And again, if we missed any payment, they get a lien in our property. Those are not characteristics of a license. Those are characteristics of an easement. And again, an easement and characteristics that need to be determined by a finder of fact. It is not appropriate for summary judgment. At a minimum, this needs to be reversed and remanded for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you. And you will have rebuttal, Mr. Weinberg. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
May it please the court. Dave Hashmall for respondent. I think it's important that we begin by looking at the legal principles that control this case.
Ambiguities are construed against the drafter?
Yeah, I'm not sure who the drafter is here, but that would be a controlling principle. But we have to determine and enforce the intent of the parties, and we have to do so based upon the language, and the court may not rewrite, modify, or limit the language, and the court may not render any provision meaningless. Those are basic provisions of contract construction.
Would you also agree, Mr. Hashmill, that we have to read that another principle of contract construction is we have to sort of look at the agreement as a whole to try to figure out what all of this means together?
You bet.
Okay.
You bet. But looking at it as a whole, in this case, does nothing to change the key operative language. What those principles say is, boiled down to plain English, you have to enforce contracts as written. This is not a game of fancy footwork. The question is, what does the contract say? Here, we have that controlling law. We have the undisputed facts. By the way, just to deal with it, this question of something to try, on page 21, first sentence of their argument, material facts are not in dispute. That's what they say, and that's true. No one has identified a fact that's in dispute. What is said is people—
Counsel, though, assuming there's an ambiguity, would you agree that this matter is not appropriate for summary judgment?
No, not at all. Because what would happen at trial? As their own memo says, the facts are not in dispute. There's nothing to be added to the record. And below, they did not present any facts in dispute. So this is a circumstance where, if the agreement needs to be construed, all the facts were in front of the trial court. You can look at their memo. They don't identify any facts in dispute. And you can say, we now need to decide. And we need to decide based upon the principles that I just mentioned. What is the language of the agreement? Not fancy footwork. What is the language of the agreement? And I submit that the undisputed facts are that we rejected this payment. That's undisputed. The undisputed fact is that the agreement says that what's required is payment and acceptance. And it doesn't just say and acceptance. It says together with acceptance by security. That makes it plain that it's an additional requirement, something that we need to do.
To play, following up on Judge Cochran's excellent point, why couldn't we say this? Or why does this scenario not work? It's ambiguous. You refuse to accept the money. The fact question is created as to whether by refusing to accept the money you were allowed to terminate. And for that, we look at the course of conduct between the parties, the letters back and forth, which seem to first focus on whether or not they were blocking the area, blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden, it's done as of May 1st. And a jury can decide the fact question as to whether this was properly terminated based on language that's ambiguous. I mean,
well,
why couldn't a jury decide that?
First, all that, those issues with the snow and the blocking and all that preceded the due date for the payment?
Right, but if it was so clear that you had a right to terminate, all you had to do was send a letter saying, May 1, it's over, we're not going to accept the check.
We did say that.
Did you say that from the very beginning?
In fact, it would be in the record.
Did you say that? Is that the first letter you sent, Mr. Hashmill?
I was not involved in writing the letters. We had a temporary
restraining— Were you also, I assume, not involved in saying it's an easement?
No. We had a temporary—
Well, thank God they got new lawyers.
We had a TRO hearing about the snow, et cetera, and at that TRO hearing, we said, Judge, we're going to be back because there's a payment coming up. We reserved the right not to accept that payment. Everyone knew we could not do it then because the payment was not yet due. There is nothing for a jury to decide. Ultimately, the reason there's nothing for a jury to decide is because it's not disputed that we rejected the payment. The question is the legal effect of that rejection. The legal effect of that rejection is a question of law based upon the undisputed fact. And here I come back to the fact that the controlling legal principle is we must look at the language, the contract's language, and we may not rewrite, modify, or limit its effect.
Well, let me ask you this, Mr. Hashmill.
Yes.
All right. Let's say for the sake of argument, I agree with you that the language is not ambiguous. And so there's not a fact question on these circumstances.
Sure.
But let's say, speaking for myself only, I think looking at paragraph 8 as a whole with all the language about automatically renewed and then the unless language, I say, I don't think you had the right I don't think acceptance means what you say it is. Therefore, since I believe the court erred, that you had the right to automatically terminate it on that, therefore reverse, what would happen then? Would there be a trial? Well, according to at least some of the briefs filed by Mr. Weinberg, if I say that, they win, and they're asking us to rule in their favor as a matter of law, even though they didn't move for summary judgment below. I'm not so keen on that, speaking for myself. But would we remand it to say, no, the court erred in how it interpreted the contract, so that's not moot. Therefore, you couldn't terminate it the way you think you could, i.e. by not accepting the check as of May 1. Would it then be remanded to see, well, are there any other grounds for termination, i.e. the parking, the snow, or anything else, or what would happen?
Yeah, so I guess, candidly, I don't have the procedural posture very clearly in mind. I guess there could be an issue about the snow and all of that, but I think more to the point is that on the issue of, if the court was to say no, receipt equals acceptance, then we're done on that issue. And the problem is that it has then completely removed that provision from the contract. What automatic means here is that when there's payment, there doesn't need to be any execution and doesn't need to be any further memorialization. It's automatic to that extent. It's not automatic to the extent that nothing is required and it just keeps going. They themselves agree that automatic means payment is required. There's no, but what the contract says is not payment is required. The contract says payment together with acceptance. The point being that
how is in interpreting the contract as a whole, the contract is clear that this was intended to resolve this ongoing dispute between the parties about the parking in this area. How is your interpretation that this basically, there's a renegotiation every year consistent with the party's intent to resolve that ongoing dispute? I mean, doesn't that open up the dispute every year?
Well, yes and no, to this extent. First, to set context, they're talking about what happened 50 years ago, this resolution of the dispute and all. Remember, they purchased the property in 2015. They had to obtain, because it's not an easement, they had to obtain our consent to the transfer of the agreement to them, which is why there's an estoppel certificate. They, when they purchased the property, they saw that it was a year-to-year agreement. They purchased the property subject to that. They now want to increase the value of their building at our expense by changing their rights. But to your point, yes, the parties had a dispute 50 years ago, and yes, they resolved it. And yes, they found it satisfactory to resolve it with a year-to-year contract. That worked for them. They didn't resolve it with the imaginary contract that appellants claim. Mind you, I want the court to be aware of how extreme the result appellants is seeking here. If, as Judge Connolly mentioned,
I get it. You don't want them to build a parking ramp under their building because that will dramatically increase, you know, cars going back and forth in the property. But doesn't this language in paragraph 8, dealing with the unless, unless it has been terminated upon 60 days written notice to Kindle by security for failure of the deposit system established to prevent parking or obstruction as here for its filed, to in fact prevent such parking or obstruction of such property. I mean, doesn't that language give you some rights to say, well, if they're building a parking lot under their thing, that they may be preventing parking there by having all these cars coming in effect. And so, I mean, you've got some rights there, don't you?
Sure, we have some rights, but the fact of the matter is that it allows them to continue the agreement as it exists indefinitely upon their sole discretion for all time and perpetuity because realize, what this agreement has right now, as fairly read, it has, in effect, an offer and acceptance. They pay, and if we choose to accept, they can choose not to pay, we can choose not to accept. It's a balanced agreement. Either side can end the agreement. If they get to just start crossing words out together with acceptance by, and they cross it out, it's no longer a balanced agreement. Now it's completely in their control for all time, and that not only guts the offer and acceptance framework of the agreement, but the and is commercially unreasonable result, but it is plainly contrary to the fact that it is a year-to-year agreement, as the court found. So the notion of
counsel, the language, the first unless language, unless it's been otherwise automatically terminated by failure of Kindle, now LTI, in performance of any of its covenants and agreements herein contained, what would trigger that language?
So
in your understanding language, of the agreement?
I apologize. The unless language, the way they construe it, is that we have a duty to accept, and unless certain things happen. Well, what's absurd about that is we have no duty to accept. It's our decision whether to accept or not. So when they read the unless as an exception to a duty to accept, but there is no duty to accept. The unless.
But don't they read it to mean that if these other things happen, you can terminate the contract?
No.
And what I'm trying
to. What they say is, look, the unless provisions say unless it's been terminated in this way, unless it's been terminated in that way. Well, if it's been terminated in this way and that way, then we don't need to reject the payment. So this really makes no sense at all.
Right, but let's assume they pay you the amount due, you accept it, and at some point during the year, they have failed to perform any of the covenants or agreements herein contained. What
so
can you terminate the contract at that point?
We have rights there,
yeah.
But it's
so
different.
What I'm trying to get at is, what is an example of when you could otherwise terminate the agreement under that language?
Oh, so they fail to make certain payments if they interfere with the use of the property. I don't recall the exact clauses. But the point is that does not redress the fact that they're trying to hold this agreement as a permanent agreement in their sole option for all time, which is inconsistent with the party's past dealings, where the price has gone up on three occasions from $100 to $1,000. If they can just renew it at their instance, whenever they want, forever, why did the price go up? So it's inconsistent with the way the contract's been applied. I wanted to mention a few things very quickly, because I see I'm only 2 minutes left. They talk about an easement. They've got it backwards. You don't look to see whether it's an easement and then decide it's permanent. You look to see whether it's permanent and then decide whether it's an easement. An easement, then.
I agree with you, Mr. Heschman. I don't think it's an easement.
Right. And if I may, the any a grant that can be terminated on our will is not an easement. Here, if we construct it on the property, it ends, this agreement ends. So it is, by definition, not an easement. That's the end of the easement issue. I want to just quickly touch on this 2015 amendment. There are a few points that need to be made about that. First, with regard to the lien language would apply to any amounts that are due, so the fact there's a reference to a lien does not control anything. The paragraph 2 of the 2015 agreement says it amends paragraph 3 regarding payment. It doesn't say it amends paragraph 8, which is regarding the extension of the agreement. So there is the 2015 agreement does not is just not germane to paragraph 8.
I'll give you a couple extra seconds I'm interrupting. I mean, you would agree at the end of the day, there's no language in this agreement that says you have the right to terminate this for any reason or no reason, on 30 days' notice, right?
Not on 30 days' notice.
At the end of each year. Or there's no language that says you have the right to automatically terminate this agreement at any time, period.
Not at any time, period. At the end of each year, we can choose not to accept the payment.
And there's no language in the agreement that says we have the right every year to, in our sole discretion, terminate this agreement for any reason.
In effect, it does.
Well, there's
no
language that.
Just like there's, not those words, but just like there's no language that says they have an obligation to pay, there's no language that says we have an obligation to accept. They can choose not to pay. We can choose not to accept. That's our right. The last thing I would just say about the 2015 agreement that it says this is not an easement and cannot be recorded, the 2015 amendment, I think that makes plain that no one viewed it as an easement up to that point, and they were just confirming the fact that it was not an easement.
So one last question, Mr. Hashmill. So by this, by, you would say if this language is in any residential lease, a landlord would have the right, simply by not cashing a tenant's check, to terminate the lease.
This is a, I don't practice in the area of landlord-tenant law.
Let's say it's any lease.
This is a commercial.
So you're saying this language in any lease gives you the right, by refusing to accept payment, to terminate the lease, period?
Yes, there's no question.
Wow.
There's no question that it does so, and I want to.
I can't imagine a bank then agreeing to giving them money or an estoppel certificate if that was the correct interpretation.
Well, I don't know if the bank gave anyone money for an estoppel certificate.
Or accepting, advancing a loan to do anything with if that's the way the language
works. That goes to a very important point. That goes to a very important point, because they suggest in their memo that in some sense they don't have access to the property. That's not the case at all. They have an easement, a real easement, that runs off of Fifth Street that gives them complete access to the property. It's reflected in the diagram on, I think it's page 4 of my memo and page 5 of their memo. But they have not only that, because their memo suggests that, gee, we're going to have trouble accessing our property. In fact, there's no citation to the record on that, because they can't access their property. And because I would invite the court, you mentioned the garage, Judge Conley, I would invite the court to ask to clarify the confusion that's created in their memo, where they suggest they may not be able to access the property. I would invite the court to ask appellant's counsel whether or not they are in fact constructing the garage as we speak, and whether or not they aren't going to drive up the easement that comes off of Fifth and go into the garage in the building. I would invite that, because the misleading comments that they made in their memorandum about not being able to access their multi-million dollar property, there's nothing in the record to support it. I think that question should be directed at appellant's counsel.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hashmill. Mr. Weinberg, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you. I want to.
Well, I'll bite. So, can you access the property?
I was going to ask, are there any questions? So, the statements are not misleading. What we said is we can't access it off of Washington Avenue. That's what we said. We said we can't access those parking stalls without this access agreement, this easement. That's what we said. We do have access to the property, and there is a garage that is constructed on the other side of it. But there are 12 parking stalls, and right now in the North Loop and in Minneapolis, and in 1967, it was critically important to have off-street parking and off of Washington. We're not misleading anybody.
Counsel, I have a question. Going back over this in terms of your client's ability, the 2015 agreement for the $1,000 license fee provides for 1.5% annual, $15 increase. Is it your position that even in a time of high inflation, we're not there now, but someday, that's capped as long as you get that money to the other side? You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely, right. We have an ongoing obligation, and to this
point. No, you misunderstand me. What if they're starting to lose money because of inflation and it's capped at 1.5%?
Sure.
Are you saying that's the way this is written?
That's exactly how it's written. In fact, that's why.
So acceptance isn't involved there. You can go on forever paying 1.5% in a 20% inflationary environment.
Absolutely, because that's the deal that they struck. And we all agree that it needs to be interpreted by its terms. But at the same...
You can finish your...
At the same time, every time there was an assignment, they took it upon themselves to increase that fee. If we actually say that this is year to year and we have that inflationary period, guess what they do? They'd say, oh my God, this should be $1,000 right now, but we've been getting $100 for the last 30 years. just reject the payment. Say I want $1,000. Say I want $5,000. Say I want $10,000.
Well, the previous people did agree to $1,000 in 2015.
But it was tied exactly to an assignment. If their interpretation is correct, you wouldn't need to wait for that moment in time in order to up the fee. You'd simply say, I'm rejecting it unless you pay me $1,000.
And it would be annual. Every year.
Whenever.
Every year, both sides would decide what's fair, and neither one could walk away.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we could make that decision, although I would argue that we cannot make that decision anymore because, and they did it again today, they completely ignored the Third Amendment. I believe that the Third Amendment guts the mechanism in paragraph 8. I'm addressing paragraph 8 because that's what the district court made its, I think, erroneous decision on. But if we miss this payment, it doesn't just end. It's clear what happens. There's a lien against our property for the missed payment amount, and it includes that annual fee. If their interpretation was right, you wouldn't need any of that language. It wouldn't be operative at all.
So if the agreement from 1967 went on in perpetuity on payment of the amount by April 15th, unless the other conditions arose, why enter into these subsequent agreements?
The amendments, again, are all tied to when there was an assignment of a transfer of the property. So it was recognizing the assignment of the property, and which is required underneath the agreement. And then they took it upon themselves at that point in time to renegotiate terms. Again, if you wanted to renegotiate terms at any point in time and they could just simply had the unfettered right to reject payment, that's what they would have done. But it goes to, and that's why our interpretation is reasonable. On summary judgment, they have to show that our interpretation is unreasonable. They can't do that. It's a reasonable interpretation at this stage in the proceedings. I also want to address something that Judge Connolly asked about the refusal to accept and how many times have they mentioned that they had this refusal to accept. There were 4 letters sent, 2 by Mr. Hoshmall's firm, and not once did they say that they were refusing to accept the payment. And in fact, 2 of those letters came after we had tendered the payment. We tendered the payment and that's at addendum 30 through addendum 37, our addendum. We tendered the payment on January 24th. They took 3 months to finally tell us that they weren't going to accept it. So this audit, this acceptance that there has to be this affirmative, that acceptance doesn't mean receipt.
Well, wasn't that because, I mean, I thought there was some question that the property manager screwed up. Like he took the check and then they realized they didn't want that, and then they, was there not some question with the property manager taking the money, and then they didn't want him to do that, so then am I wrong on that?
So their property managers, who they designated to take the payment, where we're supposed to send it, whatever happened between them, I don't know. But the point being is that we did tender it, and that they held it for 2 months. But what it goes to show is that on this point of acceptance, why do you need to, what are they supposed to do? How do we ever know that the payment's accepted? Ever. It means receipt. There is meaning to that. We have to make the payment. And as long as
they sent it back, I think that's a pretty good indication they didn't accept it and didn't cash it. I mean, that's what I'd do.
Sure. But you could arguably do that, but that's exactly why we're here today.
Yeah.
But we believe
it's got nothing to do with the ramp.
Correct. Well, yeah, for another time, so.
Oh, God, I hope. I can't wait.
Thank you
very, very much, Mr. Weinberg. Thank you very much, Mr. Hashmal. The matter was well argued. Mr. Hashmal, it was nice to see you again, sir.